everyone, and welcome to Keeping Them Safe. I'm Sharon Doty, here to empower you to create an environment where all children are safe from sexual predators and where we can ensure that we are doing everything possible to keep them safe. Today, we're going to continue to talk about predators, how they work, what they do, how they gain access to our kids, and what we need to know about them so that we can create environments where they have no access to our kids. So I want to talk about research that's been done that actually worked with convicted predators and looked to see with them, through them, how this whole world of child sexual abuse gets perpetrated and perpetuated. The research started in about 1985, and that's when criminologists started to speak to predators to ask them, how do you gain access to kids? You know, we don't have to ask them, what do we do to the kids? What they do to the kids, we could ask them that question, but we already know because the kids told us. We're aware because medical professionals were able to demonstrate it, or those who are forensic interviewers were able to uncover it in conversations with kids. So we know what they did. Our question always has been, how did you do it so that we could stop them before it happens? We also know how to treat it. We know a lot of things we can provide and therapies we can engage with that will empower children, that will give children and young people and even adult survivors the tools they need to come back from that, to leave that behind, to create a world and create a life that isn't given by that incident. What we've known less about all this time is how predators go about gaining that access. I mean, it's easy to see when someone snatches a child off the streets, but that really is a very small percentage of what risks there are to our children. I mean, statistically, that's only 11% of the problem. Now, 11% of a big problem is still a big problem. But that means almost 90% of the problem, almost 90% of the people who molest our children are people known and trusted by us and known and trusted by our children. So we began to look at this whole thing from a different perspective. We started to look at how does a predator go from never having done it to completion. How do they get from one point to the next? The question we asked was, how did you do what you did? Now, I want to talk a little bit about a research study that was done in Australia, because a group of criminologists in Australia, not social scientists like me or like people in my field who are simply looking for answers regarding child molesters, but these are people who study criminals. They are criminologists, and they applied the findings in those studies that they had done on property crimes and burglaries. They applied those concepts to this question, as they put it, to convicted child molesters, because what they wanted to see was if they could come up with some possible prevention tools that the world could adopt that would stop abuse before it happened. They had a different perspective, but they were looking at the same thing that we've been engaged in since the late 90s. So they started to look at what they call a crime script. Now, the scripts for property crimes and burglaries are how they tell the story of how a crime happens by considering the steps taken from idea to completion. Wow, that's exactly what we want to know. So they took that concept that they've been studying for years in other kinds of crimes, and they applied it to convicted child molesters. They started to look to see whether there was a script in use to gain trust of children and to sexually abuse them. And they also wanted to know whether identifying that script could help us find ways to prevent abuse from happening. It's interesting because this is the very question we asked in 1996 when we started this inquiry of looking for an alternative approach to prevention that would empower adults to create environments where this abuse could not occur. When we started asking that question, we were asking it from the perspective identified by David Finkelhor in his book, A New Theory in Practice, Child Sexual Abuse, that said that in order for child sexual abuse to occur, four things have to be present. Now, I've mentioned those four things before, but I think they're worth saying again so that we continue to remember that first, there has to be someone who has either a propensity for or a desire to engage in sexual romantic interactions with a young child or a child. The second element that has to be present is that that person doesn't do anything to inhibit their own behaviors, to stop themselves from acting on that desire. The third element that must be present is there has to be an environment in which it can occur. And the fourth element is that the predator, the potential predator, must be able to overcome the child's resistance to their advances. Now, as we've mentioned before and talked about on more than one occasion, previous efforts at prevention have focused on that last element. It's easier because we can gather children in a location, in schools and programs, we can gather them in a location where we can teach them how to say no, how to stand up for themselves, how to run away, and how to report to a responsible adult. We can teach kids how to say no, run away, and tell something. And we can teach adults how to deal with that disclosure. But until we started looking at this question from a different perspective in 1996, people in the field, social workers, social scientists, psychologists, and researchers that I've worked with and known over the years, could only see our fast path to prevention through children. They could only see that because there really was no access to groups of adults. When we said, okay, well, we need to find an access to groups of adults, but once we get them located, what are we going to give them? What tools are we going to give them to allow them to prevent this from happening? Not to keep it from happening again, which of course we always want to do because it will happen. But that isn't our focus. Our focus is not on keeping it from happening again. Our focus is on keeping it from ever happening. So that's where we were looking from, what David Finkelhor proposed as the elements that must be present. And if all four of them are not present, then child sexual abuse doesn't happen. So we were looking from that perspective. This group of criminologists that study crime, that study the scripts of crime, how a crime happens, began to say, okay, we've now looked at property crimes and burglaries and other kinds of crimes. Let's take these findings about how crime scripts work and see if it also applies to child molesters and whether it can give us some prevention tools we could adopt that would stop abuse before it happens. So they started to look again to see whether there was a script in use to gain the trust of children and to sexually abuse them. The research they did reinforces the findings that are at the source of our program. And it also enhanced a couple of elements that can be of value to all of us in this effort to create safe environments. So I want to talk about those. I want to talk about some of those things they saw, looking at it from a completely different perspective, and how what they saw can enhance or expand a couple of the elements that we've spoken about or we've looked at. So let's begin by just looking at what did they find? In their interviews and their surveys with convicted offenders, the researchers found that 89% of them use love and attention to gain the potential victim's trust. We've talked about that, and we'll talk about that some more, but they use psychological tools based in what occurs for the child as genuine love and attention to gain that victim's trust. And they say things like, "I don't know why your dad wouldn't let you do that. If I was your dad, I'd let you do that. I know your parents don't have time for you right now, but you should always know I'm here for you." 90% of them. Well, 88.7%. But it reinforces that message that we've had from the beginning, that psychological grooming is a key element in the process for gaining access to victimizing children. Now, 49.5%, pretty much 50% of them, also said they showered the potential victims with gifts and privileges. Well, that sounds an awful lot like things like giving gifts without permission, with ignoring parents' rules. Also sounds like allowing kids to do things their parents wouldn't allow. And 35% of them said they used gifts and privileges to lure the victim to a specific location. Remember, one of the things that we have repeatedly pointed to in these conversations is that there has to be an environment in which this abuse can occur. So there has to be a private location. Predators use gifts and privileges. Come to my house because you won't have any limitations on the video games you can play, on the access you can have to the internet, on what you can eat and drink, and maybe even on drugs. Gifts and privileges. Which leads me to the next piece of information they gathered, which is that 33%, a third of the people interviewed, admitted that they victimized children in the offender's home. So they lure kids to their home using gifts and privileges, and that's where the abuse occurs. 82% of them exploited a set of circumstances or a specific situation to be alone with the child. Now, what does that mean? Well, it can mean any number of things, but let me just give you a couple of examples. So, for example, the child is upset with their parents, sometimes they just walk out the door. They just say, "I'm running away," or "I'm leaving," and they go. And the predator says, "Come on over to my house. It's too cold to be outside, or it's rainy, or it's snowy, or it's too hot. Just come on over here. You can stay here for a while you calm down." They exploit that set of circumstances. They exploit a specific situation. A parent dies, or there's an accident, or some member of the family becomes ill, and the parent's attention is now refocused there. Those are the kinds of circumstances and situations that predators exploit. And we're going to talk more about that later. 85% of them also took actions to desensitize the victim to sexual contact. Now, remember when we started to speak about grooming, the first thing we talked about was physical grooming. That might start with a pat on the back, but the touch becomes more and more sexual and more intimate over time. And that's what desensitizes the victim to sexual contact. And the last statistic that we thought was relevant to this conversation is that 38% used gift giving or threats to withdraw love and affection as strategies to secure silence from victims and assure that there was no disclosure. Gift giving or threats to ensure secrecy. And the threats were to withdraw love and affection, or threats that if you tell, they'll make me go and then I won't be here anymore for the family. That threat itself is one of the most powerful ones that a breadwinner, if you will, uses with a victim inside the family to keep them from speaking up, because the child can see that this person is the one that provides the home, that provides the groceries, that pays the utility bills. And if they speak up and tell, and that person has to leave, then the entire family suffers. And predators use threats like that to keep children quiet. So just like our programs, these findings point us in the direction of actions to take that we adults can take to prevent child sexual abuse in our environments. The script of criminal activity that these criminologists in Australia discovered is almost identical to the keeping them safe behavioral warning signs of potential predators. And it's almost entirely consistent with the steps we promote that you can take to create safer environments for all the children you encounter and all those that you engage with in organizations. One of the additional recommendations, however, is based on the difficulty it is to get people to strictly follow policies and procedures and to report potential problems. You know, this is one of the biggest problems we have in this arena. It is difficult to get people to follow policies, and it is even more difficult to get them to report. People are incredibly quick to talk themselves out of reporting. And another way they go about it is that they convince themselves that bringing it to the attention of their supervisors is sufficient. So what we have to remember is that predators work hard to create relationships in a way that protects them when those concerns arise. You see, people believe their own feelings about someone rather than focusing attention on the behavior. So predators cultivate relationships that promote a feeling of trust. It's incredibly insightful to get how difficult it is for people to actually pick up the phone and make a call. Pick up the phone and call 911. I was speaking recently to a pastor whose church had a similar program to keeping them safe recently, and all of those who were teaching their religious education or Sunday school classes had been through this program just in the same week. They'd been through this 2.5-hour presentation looking at these particular specific things and speaking to them not only about what to watch for, but the actions to take to intervene to keep abuse from happening. And on a Sunday, between the services at his church, he got a call. He got a call from the teachers in the area where the kids were, saying he needed to come and do something about this homeless man who had wandered into the building and was ranting and raving up and down the halls and pushing his basket around and creating havoc and really creating a scene and scaring the children. And the pastor said, "Didn't you just do the child abuse prevention program this week?" "Yes." "Why are you calling me? Why are you not calling the police?" "Well, We really thought we ought to call you, but didn't your program say to you, if this happens, call 911? Well, yes, but we thought perhaps you should do that. See, that is the kind of thinking that people have that gets in the way of them actually protecting children. And predators cultivate relationships that promote a feeling of trust. So those that are part of the group that we know and trust, their ability to keep us from speaking up and speaking out is way greater than someone who seems to be suffering from mental health issues and appears to be out of control and is actually scaring children. So the researchers in this study suggested that we involve staff and volunteers in designing the policies and procedures that regulate their own behavior and their own interactions with children, and that getting them involved in developing these policies and procedures might actually have the kind of impact we're looking for in having people begin to regulate their own behavior and their own interactions with children. That this kind of participation, if you will, in the development of policies and procedures, in the evaluation of these policies and procedures, can actually result in an additional buy-in from adults in the environment. So, creating a committee of the whole, that's not really very practical. However, you could bring some significant pieces of the proposed policies and procedures to a larger group, a group of staff and parents and volunteers, and let them be engaged in looking at, well, here are the options, here are the ways we might go, and see if that actually increases their ownership of the process and enhances their willingness to speak up and speak out and enhances their willingness to call others to do the same. See, intervening in that inappropriate behavior, man, that is a real key factor in prevention in our environments. And anything, absolutely anything we can do to promote individual ownership of those practices is going to increase the possibility of thwarting child molesters. And a second point in the research that bears reinforcement is the recommendation that parents be very careful delegating intimate parenting activities to another adult when they're gone. Things like bathing children are an opportunity for both abuse and arousal. See, when kids are old enough to bathe themselves, parents should consider putting locks on the bathroom doors to promote privacy for these times. In addition, parents really need to require specific details of planned activities in order to make sure there are no potential risks in the situation. Just because you know Johnny's mother and daddy, just because you know Susie's aunt and uncle, doesn't mean that the details of the activity have been planned in such a way that your child is not at risk. See, we keep forgetting that it doesn't matter whether the adult is somebody you trust. Being rigorous with these questions can make all the difference in protecting children. And one final thing these researchers wanted to remind us was how important it is to be diligent and take the time to really learn to recognize these behaviors and intervene. They said offenders benefit from the parents' lack of knowledge regarding the way these offenders operate. They know that you don't know. So if you take the time and develop the expertise to be able to recognize potential offenders and to thwart their attempts to groom children, then kids will be a lot safer in the world. And as adults participating in this podcast or adults who've participated in keeping them safe, our program, or who have participated in protecting God's children with the Catholic Church, or a couple of other great programs that focus on these kinds of tools. You have the ability to become proficient at recognizing and interrupting these risk behaviors, and that's our best chance of protecting children. See, the research like done by these criminologists in Australia reminds us that the work we're doing to stop predators is on the right track. We actually discovered their script and didn't know it when we'd started doing our research in the late 1990s. We started looking for the script and we discovered it, and now we've begun to teach and train and develop ourselves to be people who can recognize those risky behaviors and stop them. So, when we do that, when we do what it takes, we can protect all children by working together to keep them safe. Keeping them safe, that's our goal. That's what we're here for. We are here to protect children from the risk of predators that live in our environment and engage with our children on a regular basis. My name is Sharon Doty, and I'm grateful that you have taken the time to listen and that you keep coming back to discover more about how you can be an alert adult who creates environments where children are safe from sexual predators. I'll see you next time on Keeping Them Safe. If you have questions, please call me at 918-625-6079. And if I don't answer, please leave me a message. Or you can send me an email at swdkeepingthemsafe@gmail.com. Thanks for taking the time to listen to today's conversation. And I look forward to engaging with you in our next opportunity to keep them safe.